You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, November 8th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. A packed program for you today. Harry Siegel, journalist on Occupy Wall Street. All things Occupy Wall Street, and Lee Papa, the rude pundit, on his program to help the occupiers make it through the winter months. That and the proverbial straw that breaks the cane's back, as it were. Also, Bill Daley, corporate bagman, exiting the White House. That experiment in third way politics has fortunately and very publicly failed. Updates on the super committee. Hopefully they will fail. We'll talk about that education fail in Tennessee, brought to you by the race to the top. Tar Sands. Could that deal fail? Maybe. Hopefully. Well, I guess it's sort of an encouraging show. Even an anti-gay pastor has come out and apologized for being such a dick. All that and more. Oh, well, I guess on the other side of the ledger, global warming speeding up. We'll talk about that in the program today. Some of that may end up in the better half of the program. In fact, much of it will. Which is why every day I solemnly ask for your support to become a member of the 2011-12 Best News in Politics podcast. Yes, the Majority Report. Still debating about that 24-hour show. If we get 10 new members, I won't even debate about it over the next 24 hours. We get 10 new members over the next 24 hours, I won't even debate about it. I'll just do it. I got people who are emailing me like, don't do it. Do 3 hours. Do 4 hours. Maybe I'll do 3 or 4 hours. Maybe we'll do 6 hours or 8 hours. I'm not going to do 2 hours. That's chump change. But if we get 10 new members in the next 24 hours, I will do 24 hours because we need your membership. Briefly, well, let's go. We will take a break and we will talk to Harry Siegel. We will save the juicy Herman Cain stuff and my complaints yesterday. Headed over to the Dylan Radigan show, looking forward to a great panel. Barry Reiholtz, Nomi Prinz. We were going to talk about all things economic. It was going to be awesome. And then apparently, I just found out Michael Jackson died, I guess. Was that like a year ago or?
2009
already?
Yeah, June 2009.
So he died, and apparently his doctor was giving him basically stuff you'd give somebody who's about to go under surgery or something. And Michael Jackson died. So, breaking news, Michael Jackson died. And apparently his doctor slash confidant, who was getting paid like $100,000 a month or something, got convicted. So that essentially was the most important thing to happen, I don't know, since our last war or whatever it was. So, well, whatever. I'm not going to complain anymore. All right, we'll be right back with Harry Siegel. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Freelance journalist Harry Siegel, who's been covering Occupy Wall Street. Welcome to the program, Harry.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks for having me on.
So, Harry, a couple of things I want to talk to you about, because you've been doing some great, some of the best coverage of what's happening down in Liberty Square, formerly Zuccotti Park, for some mainstream outlets. First off, your most recent story about a week ago was about the reports of the New York Police Department essentially sending people down to Zuccotti Park to create sort of some pressure in the park. Tell me about that.
Well, I've spent a lot of time in the park, and suddenly the composition of people changed dramatically, and I was trying to figure out why. I ended up speaking with two, and when I say changed dramatically, suddenly there were sort of drunk, high, sort of dangerous characters just popping up all over the place, and it felt like a scary scene. My pregnant wife was down there, and she felt very ill at ease, understandably. I ended up talking with a couple of guys who told me that the police had told them to take it down to Zuccotti if they didn't want to get arrested when they've been drinking at Union Square. I heard similar stories from a number of people in the working groups and on the security team. And the more I looked into it, the more it looked like this was happening. That doesn't mean that it was formally NYPD policy, but it appeared that the police were not being discouraged from this, and it had picked that signal up, and we're sending guys down to try to create this sort of dark carnival scene that the New York Post wants to pretend this whole thing is. I think they may have backed off since that got a lot of attention, but it's definitely part of an ongoing push by the city to make this as difficult and unpleasant as possible without actually forcing the group out.
Did you get any police response to your piece? Did you check with any cops down there?
Yes. I spoke with cops down there. I had an off-record conversation with DCPI, which is the Deputy Commissioner for Public Information. And, you know, I don't have a memo I can hold up. I can say that the police down there that week were literally reading off a script for the first time. I talked to different officers in different parts of the park, or just hearing them talking with people, you know, occupiers who'd approach them. And they would say word for word the same thing. They have free speech rights, too, about really disruptive, mentally unstable or intoxicated people. And just seemed to actively be looking not to intervene and to see if this could help run the thing into the ground while they stood on the outside.
Interesting. Now, let me ask you this. I mean, you've covered New York City for quite a while. If that guy, let's say, you know, the typical guy who is drunk and being belligerent had come up to me or somebody else in, let's say, Union Square and was doing that, and I went to a cop, well, how would a cop handle it? Would he say, well, you guys got free speech, or what would he do?
No, he, you know, if a citizen goes to a cop and says someone is being loud and disruptive, a cop would go and see what this guy's deal was. And if he was, in fact, being drunk, belligerent, on the verge of a fight, generally officers would intervene. And this is a point where what you want are regular on-the-ground cops to use their common sense and discretion. And it seemed like within Zuccotti that had gone away. Now, if I'm being fair to individual police officers, it's a complicated situation
right, going
into the park. If you're there with really good reason for someone people have asked you to take out, you're still going to be surrounded by a crowd that's moving in very close to you, holding up cameras in your face, screaming pig, that sort of stuff. So I think there is probably a fairly higher threshold for intervention. But it seems like the police department and the authorities in general are doing everything they can here to just not treat the occupiers like citizens, but as a group that's a problem. And if you go up to Albany, where for complicated political reasons, the local authorities have been nothing but accommodating, it's remarkable. It's just pleasant to be in the park. There's no danger feel at all. They've had porta potties from jump. They have generators. When I was up there, the fire chief came in to do a safety tour. And instead of taking away the generators, in the early morning with no warning, he came in to make sure that they were being handled safe, to make sure there was an evacuation plan. And he treated the people there like people he was supposed to be protecting, as opposed to a group that the New York City has treated as some sort of opposition or foreign body. And that's really how protest has been dealt with for 10 years.
Now,
at least.
Let's talk about the generators. I've seen a video where a generator was actually taken from a guy who had a food stand essentially next to the park. The food stands have all moved alongside the park because there's more business for them there. But he's got a permit for this generator, and it was taken away. What's happening along the generator lines?
That's interesting. I didn't know that about the food stand guys. I know they're one of the people journalists have gone to when we've needed to recharge our devices. And the occupation ones have been full. There's the guys with generators you can charge with. Within the park, they've been using these bike generators now, this pedal power, reasonably successfully. But it's difficult with having some power needs, and as conditions get colder, for just maintaining the physical occupation itself. It's also one of these old things that just makes it harder for journalists to cover the story. The lack of porta potties. I've been penned in on a number of occasions where being pressed has not earned me any sort of special treatment. And press may be the only important thing here, but it's a deterrent. So when 700 people get arrested, or just when three, you know, loud protesters get pepper sprayed, it says to lots of people, do I really want to be covering this story? Is this a level of engagement I'm comfortable in? It sort of creates a threat around the whole thing that's been meant to limit the extent of participation, to say this is just kids in cars. And I think that's backfired badly up till now, but it's clearly one of the tactics that the city and the police in particular have been using. Is again to treat this as some sort of a dangerous group that there are potentially consequences for being around or associating with.
Yeah, let's talk about how it's backfired. I mean, obviously, on some level, it's backfired because it's giving it's getting press attention for the occupation. But it seems to me that another way that it's backfired is that if you believe, as I do, that the actual physical occupation itself is the most important part of the of this ongoing protest, in some ways, hasn't the police just made the occupiers that much more capable? I mean, don't they have to? I mean, it's almost as if like it's like the police are in the city by being hostile, by putting obstacles up, is almost training these people on how to really have a successful occupation. You know, that which doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Is that the dynamic? Is my assessment of that correct from your perspective?
Man, that's spot on. The reason the occupation is the most important part of this much broader protest movement is it's become this tremendous symbol, largely because of the hostile response. So prior to the pepper spraying, prior to the arrests on the Brooklyn Bridge, this really was more or less just a local story. And if, say, 100 people went to sleep in parks in Albany, it would barely even in a park in Albany would barely even be a local story. Suddenly, it's part of a much bigger national narrative that's somehow connected to these people who are physically occupying these parks. And in this long-standing cat-and-mouse game between the police and other authorities and protesters dating back to Seattle or 9/11, depending on how you want to count, it seems to me like the police have really played into the occupiers' hands. They've gotten smarter and more competent as they've been tested and pressed. And I don't think what the police are learning by watching techniques as this happens and adjusting is really in their interest. It seems to me like it plays entirely into the hands of the occupiers. It makes them smarter, more competent, more aware of their legal rights, and it attracts tremendous attention without these guys having to get into their goals or demands that I'm not sure would be there otherwise. In a lot of ways, it seems like the police should has created the narrative where the occupiers have chosen not to, while they're trying to build a broader tent without getting into particularly what they want.
Yeah, that's a good segue into the actual tents. My understanding is that there's been, I mean, it's been amazing to me to watch the sort of the inclusion of tents. And as far as I can tell, it dates back to that night when Jesse Jackson happened to be in the park and protected the medical tent from the police. And since then, the park has become full of tents. And now there seems to be another stage where there are military tents going up. Tell me about that.
Well, the Jesse Jackson thing was very interesting to me. I'd sadly left the park about a half an hour earlier, about 2:30 in the morning, if I recall. And so wasn't there. But from a lot of what I heard from people who've been who were there and saw it happen, it wasn't clear the police were even going to take down the medical tent. But by going into the park and creating that optic and appearance, it was another of those powerful symbolic moments. At a certain point, as the mayor has calibrated and recalibrated his approach, they more or less gave in on tents. The mayor has said it's up to this property management company what happens. Whether or not I send in thousands of police, it's not really a decision I'm making. And the occupiers, again, intelligently have taken advantage of his tactic of not wanting to be the guy who pushes the button to really build up a bigger physical presence in the park. Now, at this point, it starts getting covered with tarps and then tents as no one responds and takes them down. And at a certain point, there's almost no common space left. And this idea of a public commons that has really vanished in the last decade, in part because of the internet, in part because of bogus security concerns, mostly bogus security concerns, is tremendous. So it can't just be a tent city with no place for people to be outside and engage with each other. And what they're trying to do now is build up bigger tents, have more planning in terms of where exactly in the park they're going, which is always a tricky and complicated process, and to make sure that there's both space for people who are occupying 24/7 and for people to come in and engage and feel like they're part of something. I'm curious if this will be a trigger for the city to respond and try to take out the tents entirely, which they'd done previously and then backed off of.
And so, wait, so you're suggesting that the idea behind the bigger military-style tents is to have fewer structures in the park so that some of the actual park territory can be freed up for people to sort of congregate more?
Yes.
Okay.
There has to be a physical commons, and there has to be some planning. I mean, this is 7 weeks old. It's been so haphazard up till now. And, you know, there's an attempt with winter coming, although it's beautiful today, to sort of consolidate these gains and to take some of the things that just sprung up willy-nilly and structure them more sensibly so that this can maintain.
All right, let's talk about a little bit about, you mentioned how Bloomberg has constantly recalibrated his strategy. And when we talk about what the police are doing, for the most part, we have to assume that this is a function of orders they're getting. I've seen it reported that Bloomberg meets every day with a sort of an ad hoc committee as to mm-hmm. what to do about it. Give me your sense of what is Bloomberg doing in all this, both in terms of how he's having sort of the practical implications of what he's doing, but also things like going out and saying, getting involved in sort of the idea of like, it's not the bank's fault that the financial crisis happened. It's out of Washington. What's going on with the Bloomberg administration?
Well, I think there's several different things going on.
Oh, hold on for 1 second. Harry, we're losing you a little bit. If you could just, I don't know if you're moving around at all, but if you if you're able to hold still, that'd be great.
Yes. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, that's great.
Sorry about that. So the administration has kept recalibrating, and Bloomberg clearly doesn't want these people here. He has what's in fact a perfectly rational, internally consistent argument about how banks aren't compliant that he's a horrible messenger for. This is the richest man in New York City, who's also its elected mayor, who spent $500 million on the books, more off it, to hold that office, overturned term limits without a referendum. At the same time, he's thinking a lot about what he wants to be when he leaves office. You know, he wanted to be president. He's from 05 to 08, really. That was the only reason he was mayor. To pull that off. And, you know, he's just spent $6 million on advertising. This guy is term-limited out, swears he doesn't want any other office to burnish his brand and to prepare for a career outside of being mayor. And for those reasons, among many others, New York is not going to be Oakland. There is an extent to which he's willing to tolerate something he doesn't like, but he'd really love to push this out. He has Howard Wolfson now, who's a longtime Clinton aide, who's now a deputy mayor, as one of his key people dealing with this, and I think they've been very frustrated by the lack of official leaders or channels through which they can deal with these guys. They can try to buy people off or negotiate. And in the absence of those channels, and there have been, I'm told, you know, some back channel communications, but not much. He keeps sort of blindly, I think, switching tactics to see what will discourage these people or push them out. And so far, the results have gone from having no impact to with things like the Park Queenie a couple weeks ago, and the arrest to just making this bigger and bigger and bigger. And at this point, I think he feels at a loss for what his next move responding is. I'm told that they're really hoping the winter will take care of this on its own, but it's very obvious that's not going to be the case. These people are not just going to go home. And like you said, and they agree, the physical occupation of this one small, by itself meaningless park, in the shadow, as a matter of fact, of Ground Zero, is the most important symbol of this national political movement. It's just not going to go away of its own volition.
I have to say, you know, I mean, I think that is the one of the most inspiring things about what's happening there is just that how frustrated they have left the
the some of the most powerful people supposedly in the country, the richest, most powerful people in the country, seem completely powerless to really influence what happens in that park. And it's stunning to watch. And I know we just have a couple minutes here, but I want to just touch on, tell me a little bit about the Spokes Council. That is sort of the newest sort of iteration of what's happening. They met for the first time the other night. Just tell my listeners exactly what is the Spokes Council and how is that different from what existed in terms of structure before it?
Yes, this is really interesting stuff. The short version is there was this General Assembly, which was literally whoever showed up on the steps of the park by Broadway at 7 every night. And this group of those people made all the money decisions, and in some ways all the bigger ones. So it was an entirely open process. There were facilitators, but anyone could participate. The group operated by consensus or modified consensus, which means at least 90% of the people there had to agree for any money over $100 to be spent. And as this grew and grew past anyone's expectations, the General Assembly became this tremendous symbol of engagement and direct democracy and people really getting involved. But it also meant that the members of the working groups and the people who were putting in all of the time weren't able to make sensible decisions. So they created this idea, they took this long time, much more traditional anarchist idea of a Spokes Council, where small, basically independent groups of people who have become quite involved work on their own and then meet as a group with the representative from each working group to make these operational decisions. So you don't have 3 hours of debate about whether to spend $1,000 on laundry when laundry needs to get done. The issue is it obviously means a higher threshold for involvement. And it does take away some of the power of the GA, which still makes movement-wide declarations, but suddenly really isn't in control of most of the finances and most of the operational decisions. So that took, I think, five GAs for that to finally pass, and the proposal kept getting refined. And it's a much more functional structure, and the timing with Winter is actually excellent because it pushes lazier journalists off the trail. There is a point where you could just go to the GA and leave with the story and sort of all the information about what was happening, what events were coming up and decisions without really having to do terribly much work. I mean, just show up in the park. And that was attracting people who weren't sort of spending the time to have a broader sense of what was happening and saw this pathway to pushing out news. And that's gone away. On the negative side, it means that there is a little less oversight and clarity with smaller tactical decisions that people are making, both in terms of long-term planning and really immediate needs, like doing laundry or how direct action would respond if something actually happens in the park. So it'll be very interesting to see how this plays out and whether or not this deters a larger group from getting involved, which I don't expect it will. But what's wonderful about this story from a newspaper man's point of view is we really don't know where it's going.
Right.
Because no leaders and there are no demands, and it's flummoxed all of these powerful people because of that, it's also fascinated the press. When organized labor marches, they show up where they say they're going to be, when they say they're going to be. They say more or less the same scripted things, and then they go away. Here, it's every day, it's a surprise what the occupiers are going to do, how the city is going to react, what, if anything, this is going to mean nationally and in 2012. And that is a great story.
Yeah, well, it's fascinating, and it's also very inspiring from my perspective. And Harry, I really appreciate your speaking to us about it, and hope to speak to you again soon as this continues through the winter months.
Yes, thanks, and it's been my pleasure.
All right, folks, we got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to another guy, actually down in the park at the moment, Lee Papa. You know him as Rude Pundit. He's got, he's pushing for a program to help the occupiers make it through the winter. We'll be right back with that right after this.
All right, folks, we are back on the Majority Report on the phone from Liberty Square, formerly Zuccotti Park. Lee Papa, the Rude Pundit, author of the Rude Pundit Almanac, but in Zuccotti Park to make a video in support of his initiative, Blanket the Earth. Welcome to the program, Lee.
Thanks a lot, Sam.
So, all right, tell me, what is Blanket the Earth?
So what the way this started was I was talking to some other bloggers and activists about what we can possibly do to help out with the occupiers around the country being able to stay in the park through the winter, and that was actually going to be key to the success of the movement, I think, in the coming next year in the spring and summer. And other organizations have been raising money. I know that the blogs Fire Dog Lake and Jane Hampshire have been doing their Occupy Supply. And we decided that there should be a show of support in a very physical way. And so what I want to do is, in different cities, on Black Friday, November 25th, instead of shopping, get people to go to their local occupation and gather, and then as a group, donate blankets, socks, hand warmers, foot warmers, the gear that they'll need to get through the winter. And so far, it's taken off really nicely. People are organizing in Nashville and Austin and Boston and Chicago and D.C. to do this.
And so, I mean, give me a sense of, just from your perspective. I mean, I you know, I've read what you've written in support of this thing. First tell me, where can people, if people are interested in getting involved or starting their own group, for instance, I'll probably be in Worcester, Massachusetts. I know there's an Occupy Worcester. Can I just go down on that Friday morning with some hand warmers or some blankets, or should I assemble online somewhere and meet people down there? What should I do?
Well, that's what I would like. I would like people to assemble if somebody is organizing that for an assembly, and then go down as a group. I think that would be a strong, positive show of support from the public that are not doing the hard work that the occupiers are doing. I mean, we do support them, but I think that this is something very tangible to show that we're here for you. So if there's nothing organized, I would then say just wherever you are, wherever your occupation is, go down there and donate on that specific day. And
do you guys have a site set up, a Facebook page?
Right now there's a Facebook page for Blanket the Earth. There's already one for Blanket the Earth in Atlanta. And I'm starting to coordinate some things with some of the Occupy media people. So hopefully we can get a good show of support on that date.
And Lee, give me a sense just from, why this movement, why what's going on is so important from your perspective.
I just find something so authentic about it. One of the things I've often complained about on the blog is that so often what we consider protest is actually something that is sanctioned by the government. There's very few times that a protest is something that that rises on its own, exists in an unruly way, away from government regulation, and as much as it can, without everybody being arrested. Although certainly they've tried in different places, and so that to me, there's an organic nature about this that is really encouraging. And I've been down here now at least once or twice a week since it started, and I've seen it grow to what now is starting to look like the compound on MASH. You can hear I'm near the drummers. I'll try to get away from them. They're ubiquitous, though.
I understand. I've been down there. I mean, it's interesting because, I hadn't really contemplated this, but it's going to be very weird when we get to things like the Republican National Convention and the Democratic National Convention, and when the police try and set up their free speech zones. I wonder if – I hadn't really contemplated it, but as you're mentioning it, I wonder if this is essentially the end of
for at least all intents and purposes, the concept of a free speech zone. I mean, who is going to go back now to the idea that, oh, you're giving us permission to protest as long as we stay inside this cage over here?
Right. I mean, it's almost something, what is the concept in physics, that something that is free will assert itself as free. And so no longer, I think that what this demonstrates is that that only government-approved speech can be allowed in the public space. That this is showing, no, there's all speech needs to be allowed. And even if that speech is disruptive to the daily lives of people in various cities, that's actually more probably, no, I won't say probably, that's more what the founders intended than any of the BS rules that have been imposed on people at different protests.
And so, lastly, on a even more practical, what are, do you have a sense of what the most important thing? I mean, I guess it's a function of where you are and what supplies they already have. But do you have a sense of if I wanted to bring something down to Occupy Worcester, let's say, or Occupy Iowa, or Occupy Omaha? How can I find out what's really needed there?
Well, every occupation website has most of them, I think, have a donate list. Any place where there's a camp out going on, there is a donate list that lists the priorities. I think right now it's probably thermal blankets and sleeping bags, as well as just those hand and foot warmers that you can get, that you can just insert inside your gloves and shoes.
Okay. All right. Well, I think it's a great endeavor that you've put together, Lee, and I appreciate it. And it is Blanket the Earth on Facebook. We'll put a link up on our site at Majority FM. And I appreciate you coming on to talk about it.
Well, thanks a lot, Sam. Thanks for having me.
All right, folks. That is at least the first half of our program today. The better half of the program is coming up as we speak. I can see it coming down the road. There it is. It's working its way into our office. There we go. Folks, you can support this program after you buy some hand warmers, thermal blankets. You got an old sleeping bag? Come on. You're not going. When was the last time you went camping? Right? Give up the ghost. You're not going camping. Let's face it. You kept it there. You've had it down there for years. Oh, we're going to go on that camping trip. It's going to be great. Oh, yeah, we'll cook marshmallows. No, you're not. You're not doing it. So bring that sleeping bag down, if it's in good shape, down to some folks who are literally putting their health, their physical well-being on the line to empower people across the country, not corporations, not financial behemoths, people. If you don't have that sleeping bag in there because you haven't been deluding yourself that you're going to do that Appalachian Trail hike, go pick up some hand warmers. You can buy like 20 or 30 of them for 10 bucks. Get a bunch of those. I don't think there's a single occupation that is in the, you know, the cooler parts of the country that will not be able to use all of those hand warmers. And doing it on Black Friday is a great time to do it. You know why they call it Black Friday? Because that's supposedly when all the retail businesses get in the black for the year. You can support this show after you do that by becoming a member at Majority FM. You can also support the show by buying your crap on Amazon. Actually, why not buy some hand warmers on Amazon through our link? It's called the Twofer. You can also buy Just Coffee at justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. You know what? I bet that would be a nice post-Thanksgiving Day present for the occupiers. Some fair trade tea or coffee, or better yet, chocolate. Who doesn't love chocolate?
and you can tell them it's fair trade, it's organic. People power, people. All right, we'll see you in the better half of the show. You can call me at 646-257-3920 or I am me at Majority FM.